This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about the diversity problems and gender bias in the tech industry. Do you work in tech? Have you encountered these problems? Or maybe your company is tackling these issues. Well, we want to hear from you. Give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. If you work in the tech business and you've been involved in diversity or gender bias in the industry, or maybe you're a company that's working against it, give us a call, 844-724-8255. Tweet us at SciFry. But first, 2 weeks ago, on the night of Friday, February 5th, staff at the Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center noticed something out of the ordinary. They were having trouble logging into some of the hospital's computers. They alerted IT and soon discovered they were in the midst of an attack. Certain computer systems had been invaded by malware, encrypted, and held for ransom. The price? 40 bitcoins, or $17,000, for a key to decrypt the system. And although they did call the cops and the FBI is investigating, in the end, the hospital decided to pay the 17 grand and get their data back, sort of like the cost of doing business. A statement provided by the hospital says that the incident, quote, did not affect the delivery and quality of the excellent patient care you expect and receive from Hollywood Presbyterian. Well, is this the new normal now, paying ransom for your electronic records? And why wasn't the data backed up so the hospital could reload it into their computers? We weren't able to get a Hollywood Presbyterian spokesperson to join us, but we have someone who probably has lain awake at night worrying about this very scenario. Martin Fisher is an information security manager for a hospital system in Georgia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Glad to be here, Ira.
Any theories on how this malware got into the system?
There's so many different ways these things can show up in a system. It could be someone clicked on a link in an email, clicked on a link on a website, the malware got delivered, and it just took off.
Have you seen other cases of ransomware in action?
I have, both professionally and personally. Ransomware is a very growing method used by adversaries who are out there to make their quick bitcoins and move along.
So this is something that's happening in other hospitals that we may not have heard about. They just go and pay it because why?
For a lot of these hospitals, and it's not just hospitals, it's everywhere. I mean, there are reports that come out of police departments, that come out of pretty much every vertical, is this data gets encrypted, and you have then really one of two choices. If you have a system where you can restore from backup, and it's the what's called the recovery point, the point that you took the backup to the point now, you can afford to lose that data, you do that. Otherwise, you pay the ransom and hope that they give you the decryption key.
Aren't hospitals required to back up data by HIPAA security rules?
Yeah, the HIPAA security rule does require us to back data up, and I think hospitals do the best they can. But sometimes, and I don't know exactly what happened at Hollywood Presbyterian. I'm not even going to speculate, but with all the varied systems that hospitals have, and some of them are old, some of them are new, doing backups is hard, and sometimes IT systems don't act the way that you should. And the cost and the time it would have taken to, even if they had a robust backup program, it may have actually been easier and cheaper to pay the $17,000.
Could we be moving toward just the threat of blackmail, just the threat of closing your system down? They haven't even done it yet. You buy protection like they used to do in the racket.
That's a great metaphor, because a lot of what's happening from the cybercrime side is organized crime. This is very similar to the guy who pulled you in an alley, said $5 or I'm going to beat you up.
Yeah,
it may get to that point. We're not seeing that now because really it's a fire and forget thing for the adversary. They send out spam emails. Someone clicks on it. They're not sure who will. But when it does, the malware phones home and says, hey, I just encrypted all this stuff. Here's the key I created. And then they engage in a dialogue with the victim to see if they can extract the money.
So your opinion on paying the ransom, the cost of doing the business, or are we encouraging criminals by doing that?
So my professional information security opinion is I hate the fact that people pay ransom. As a person who's also in the healthcare industry and is interested in making sure systems come up quickly so we can serve patients effectively and not have patient safety issues, I totally understand why they made that choice.
Yeah, I get it too. I'd like to bring on another guest now who just published a report on ransomware and how much people in different countries are willing to pay for the key to their data. Livio Arsene is a senior e-threat analyst at Bitdefender, a global security technology company in Bucharest, Romania. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You just released a report on ransomware surveying attacks around the world. Is it more common in some countries than others?
Yeah, of course. Some countries are more prone to ransomware attacks, like the U.S., Germany, or other popular countries in Europe, mostly because people worry about their data and are more willing to pay to get it back.
So how do the attackers set the price? Is it different from around? I mean, $17,000 versus what around the world?
Well, it's basically $17,000 versus how much you're willing to pay. Usually these guys have a 24-hour timeline in which if you don't pay, they actually rack up the time for 48 hours or 36 hours, and then they just come up with a new price. They usually double it, triple it, and so on and so forth. But usually it sometimes goes up to $500, $600 for end users and for companies. As we've seen with the Hollywood incident, it may end up to be $17,000.
But you don't want to rack it up too high. You want them to pay the money, right?
Exactly. You want to hook the victim for as long as you can. So you give them another chance and another chance to pay the ransom.
Martin Fisher, the hospital has claimed that it doesn't believe any patient records were compromised, but is there really any way to know if the hackers copied over some data for their own use? How do you know they even are not going to do this again?
Well, these guys will definitely try it again with other people. I'm sure they're trying it with thousands of other potential victims. As far as knowing whether or not data exfiltrated or not, that's really going to be up to the experts that Hollywood Presbyterian brings in. They're going to look at logs. They're going to look at what happened and hopefully be able to detect if that data was actually exited the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Olivia, can you just buy this ransomware program on the dark web somewhere?
You'd be surprised to find out how cheap it is to buy yourself a ransomware kit. If I'm not mistaken, we found one a couple of months back. Used to be as high as $3,000, I think, and you can just buy your own ransomware kit and start delivering it to hundreds, potentially thousands of victims, and make potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars in return. So for $3,000 investment, you can end up making hundreds of thousands of dollars in ransom.
Well, why limit it to a hospital or a police department? Why not each one of us who has healthcare records? And then we get the phone call saying, hey, what's it worth to you to keep it quiet?
Well, exactly. Everybody could be a potential victim as long as you do not, take minimum precautions. For instance, you don't actually take good care of what you open during your emails, for instance, links or attachments. And you could be infected at any point. You could even be infected while browsing the web, for instance. It's called drive-by attack.
Well, I understand there's even a worse version of this called extortionware. Is that right?
Exactly. So the worst case scenario is they don't only encrypt the data, but they also download it to the attacker control server. So after you pay the ransom, you're like, okay, I got access to my data. But then the attacker comes over at you and says, okay, so if you pay us an additional amount of money, we will make sure we won't publish what we got from you online so that everybody else can see it. This could be potentially even more damaging for companies than end users.
Martin, where does this end?
I have no idea where this is going to end or how this is going to end. But what I do know is that the threat is definitely out there. These guys are definitely finding out new ways to monetize this. So it's kind of like they're making a lot of money out of us. And since 50% of us that are victims end up paying for these ransoms, we're actually fueling in this entire cyber criminal activities with money.
Martin, if we just backed up the data, would that not help?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what you're seeing in more and more companies as the ransomware has become a bigger and bigger issue, it's forcing IT groups to do more often better backups, faster recovery times, faster restore times. And that's how you end up dealing with this threat. Is no one wants to pay the ransom. So instead, a lot of IT groups are talking to their management team saying, hey, And, you know, unfortunately, Hollywood Presbyterian is going to be a cautionary tale of, do we want to be this, you know, news story? Most hospital administrations don't. So what do we have to do to not be that? And you're going to see, you know, basic IT operations is really the key to having a secure environment. And my hope is that more hospitals will look at this and decide what they need to do.
Olivia, what do you think each of us should do? Just not open strange emails? Is that what you said? Is anything else?
Well, this is at least a minimum degree of awareness that every user should have, at least in the home sector. I mean, for every private user that has an email address, please make sure that once you open an email attachment, you're sure that it comes from someone you know. For the business sector, however, that's an entirely different story, because you can have your IT administrator or your security team set up different layers of securities that can prevent this type of threat from actually reaching an employee's computer, or at least executing on an employee's computer.
Yeah, well, Martin, if we backed it all up to our iPhone, it'd be pretty secure, wouldn't it?
that's the going theory.
We'll find out. Thank you both for taking time to be with us. We're joking, but it's a very, very important story to talk about, all the security that's going on and being ready for extortionware.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here.
You're welcome. Martin Fisher, Information Security Manager for a hospital system in Georgia. Livio Arsene is a senior e-threat analyst at Bitdefender, a global security technology company in Bucharest, Romania. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to look at the diversity and technology and how can Silicon Valley include and hire more women and minorities. 21st century, still using 20th century hiring theories. So we're going to talk about that right after this short break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Earlier this month, Intel released its numbers on employee diversity. In 2015, one of the company's goals was to actively try to increase diversity. 43.1% of new hires that year were either women or underrepresented minority groups. And even with that ambitious goal, the tech giant is still sitting at 75% male, 86% white and Asian combined. And what about the newer folks in the Valley? Facebook. Facebook fares only slightly better, with 70% men and 57% white. A report out this month from the group Digital Undivided found that there were 88 startups led by black women, and of those, only 11 were able to raise over $1 million, and just half received any venture capital funding. Why can't Silicon Valley innovate ways to bridge its diversity gap? Is there a gender bias in the workplace? And how can tech retain more women and underrepresented minorities? My next guest has experience in all of these areas. First job in Silicon Valley was as the first head of employee relations, organizational development, and management training at, you'll recognize the company, Lotus. Remember Lotus? Frida Kapoor Klein is a partner at the Kapoor Center for Social Impact and founder of Level Playing Field Institute, that's based out of Oakland, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. A pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. Frida, your first job in Silicon Valley was as the first head of employee relations, organizational development, and management training at Lotus, as I said. How were you trying to approach diversity then?
Well, unfortunately, it hasn't changed as much as we think it should have. I always find it ironic that people practices have been the slowest part to change of any aspect of tech companies. So way back in 1984, my job description was to make Lotus the most progressive employer in the U.S. And we did that through a variety of initiatives, including focusing way back then on diversity. And I think all of the companies in that era made some progress, and then there was enormous backsliding, and people considered themselves to be post-diversity and that it didn't matter anymore. So we haven't had much attention to the issue for the last several years, and I'm delighted to say that Silicon Valley is, and technology and the ecosystem in general, is once again starting to take diversity and inclusion issues seriously.
And how is it doing that?
Well, there are a number of initiatives. So I think very importantly, there's been a call for transparency and accountability for companies, just as you mentioned, Intel, releasing their numbers, talking about the progress they're making and where they're falling short of their own goals, and then putting some real effort and some real dollars behind it. I also think a very promising trend is what I've been referring to as POT, People Operations Technology. So lots of companies now call their human resources function People Ops, and lots of startups are trying to mitigate bias in all aspects of hiring and employment at scale by leveraging technology. So finally, tech is using tech to solve its diversity problems.
Mm-hmm. We have some people who are involved there. Let's go to Suzanne in Oakland. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, this is Suzanne.
Hi there.
Can you hear me? I just want to bring some awareness to age discrimination in the workplace in the Bay Area. I moved from New York, which is kind of an ageless town in many ways, and experience and age are respected, and found that working for a tech company here, it was a very youthful atmosphere, and you were very aware of your age, and people made you aware of it. So I wanted to bring that to the floor.
Okay. That's Frida, age discrimination?
It is certainly an issue in tech. There have been these painful stories of people going to, you know, get hair transplant, men going to get hair transplants and dyeing their hair and plastic surgery to appear younger. I mean, that's a very unfortunate form of bias that is indeed rampant in tech companies.
You know, we see a lack. I'm trying to get my head around this issue here and why it's jumped out of Silicon Valley, because we see a lack of women and minorities in all sorts of industries, you know, the sciences certainly, and finance. What is so different about either the culture or the issue or the jobs in this problem area?
Well, I think the numbers in tech are actually worse than in other sectors, certainly than in financial services and other sectors of the economy. I think also a key issue is the culture of technology is that it describes itself as a perfect meritocracy. So in that way, tech sets itself up and then falls short. So in some ways, technology needs to get rid of the arrogance and to say, you know what, we aren't that different in key areas, that we really need to take on the myth of meritocracy. And we need to look at all the ways in which subtle and not so subtle biases impact how we do business, who we hire, who we think is qualified, and that's why we look the way we look.
When technology, remember technology used to be back east here around the Boston area before we had the Silicon Valley. Was it the same back here in those days?
Well, Lotus was founded in Cambridge.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm asking you that question.
It was. Well, in some ways, you know, in relationship to the caller's question, I'm a ancient for being somebody in tech, given that I worked in tech in the 80s. In the 80s, there was a huge group of technology companies, and Digital Equipment Corporation, that doesn't exist, was the largest private employer in Massachusetts. And it had very deep and wide diversity efforts in the 80s and 90s. And as I said, all of these efforts just kind of evaporated and people declared that, you know, they were post-diversity. So now we're really digging in again with a new generation.
Yeah, you conducted a study in 2011 looking at hidden bias in the IT workplace, and you found that men and women felt differently about how diversity was handled. Tell us
Indeed.
A little about that.
Well, we absolutely found gender differences in perceptions of how diversity is handled in tech companies. We also found profound differences between Caucasians, Asians, and African Americans and Latinos. So what we find in general is that here we are working so closely in the same environments. We're working towards one goal to make our company successful, and we have vastly different perceptions and experiences of day-to-day work life, of what it means to work on a team, of what it means to be included, of what jokes are appropriate or inappropriate, of what kinds of socializing with colleagues is appropriate or inappropriate. So what we found are things like, if you ask all of the, even if it's just restricted to the engineers and managers, and you ask, is your company doing the right amount on diversity? In general, women and underrepresented people of color say, nope, not doing enough. And the men and the Caucasians and the Asians say, we're doing just fine. Maybe we're even putting too much emphasis on this issue. So if we don't even agree how important the issue is, we're never going to solve it.
Yeah, let's go to the phones now to Arthur in North Carolina. Hi, Arthur. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you? So I think that the problem is that there's just a major cultural bias problem, and there's not a will. I happen to hold a PhD from a top-flight university. I went through a series of notoriously difficult phone screenings for one of the big players out on the in the Silicon Valley area. I passed them with fine colors. They called me in, and I went through about a day-long round of interviews. When I arrived in the lobby, I noticed that the building, as I looked around at the other applicants who were there, I was the only black person, and the others, not a female there, all white males. Mostly Asian males, white and Asian, matching the demographics of the building as I saw people coming and going and as I went around to my round of interviews. So there is no shortage. They will tell you all day long, we can't find qualified applicants. Qualified applicants are showing up. Their feedback to me ultimately, to make a long story short, was that I was not a cultural fit.
Mm-hmm. Let me get Frida. Got it.
I was not offered about.
You were not.
The
Frida. Some people argue that it is more of a climate problem. Like our caller is Arthur is saying.
Well, I'm genuinely sorry that you had that experience, and we hear that same story from underrepresented people of color all the time, and that's why they remain underrepresented. This notion of cultural fit, there is some little tiny grain of truth in that, but mostly culture fit is a huge umbrella for bias. We ought to be focusing on, as this gentleman said, who has the skills to do the job? Not, do I look like somebody you'd like to play ping pong with or have a beer with? Hmm. So, and that's where I have a lot of hope for the people ops tech companies that are coming up. So for instance, there's to this gentleman's issue, there is a platform, a company called interviewing.io has created an anonymous platform for doing coding interviews. So we don't know the gender of the person. We don't know the race of the person. We don't know where they went to school. What we immediately start with is their coding ability. So if you get a flying colors on a coding test, then it's much easier to walk in and be someone who looks different than who they hire because they already know you can do what they do every day.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Frida Kapoor Klein, in case you joined us, talking about Silicon Valley and issues of bias. Twitter received criticism recently for their pick of Jeffrey Siminoff, who was a white and a male, to head their diversity team. I mean, any thoughts on that?
Well, certainly. I think that everybody can and should be involved in diversity and inclusion efforts. What I understand is that the employee resource groups, Blackbirds, the employee resource group of black employees at Twitter, and the employee resource group for Latinas and Latinos, was not involved in the hiring. if both of those groups had a voice in the hiring and said, this is the person we want to head this function, I'd have no problem with a Caucasian male who is also out gay, and we should talk about the LGBT community also being recipients of some bias in the workplace. I think it's really about the process. It's not just about the demographics.
Mm-hmm. Myra Flato, this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Frida Kapoor-Klein, who's a partner at the Kapoor Center for Social Impact and founder of the Level Playing Field Institute out in Oakland, California. I understand that Intel is offering bonuses of up to $4,000 for employees that refer women, minorities, and veterans. Is this the right track to take? Does this work? Is it, or is it sort of, you know, your heart's in the right place, but it's misguided?
I think it takes a series of well-integrated measures to accomplish diversity goals and inclusion goals. So I applaud that Intel has taken such a thorough approach. Again, transparency, accountability, putting a lot of money behind it, lots of different initiatives. I do think, since so much of the tech ecosystem relies on employee referrals, and all of the research says most of us have friends that look like us, I think you have to make extra effort. If these companies already give a double or triple employee referral bonus for recommending, let's say, a full stack engineer of a certain kind, because that engineering talent is in short supply, I think it's an important statement to say diversity helps our business, and we're therefore going to provide a greater incentive to achieve that goal.
Let's go to Lisa in Davis, California. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
That is a perfect segue to my question about how do you establish or get the message across that diversity does actually increase the excellence of a company or an institution? I think some people overlook that kind of core tenet.
Thanks for the call.
A great question. There has been lots of rigorous research on diverse work teams as well as diversity in the senior ranks of companies. McKinsey did a study in just about a year ago, early 2015, looking sector by sector. Turns out that gender diversity in the senior ranks of a company within a sector compared to its competitors increases its financial performance and profitability by 15%. That number jumps to 35% when we're looking at racial and ethnic diversity in the senior ranks of a company relative to its competitors. So if you're just looking at rational business decisions, if you're just looking at the bottom line, you should be going after diversity.
Makes good business sense, what
exactly.
You're saying.
Exactly.
And do you have, why would you have to convince anybody of the numbers, you know, if they speak for themselves?
The numbers absolutely speak for themselves. What you're raising is the really fascinating issue of what we call hidden bias. So looking at those subtle day-to-day practices and assumptions, we've learned so much about how hidden bias operates from advances in neuroscience. So the human brain is wired to be biased. So when we look at a resume, we are influenced, even though we may not consciously recognize it, we are influenced by the name at the top of that resume. Study after study after study shows that an African-American sounding name on a resume, that person with identical qualifications gets 50% fewer callbacks for an interview than a quote-unquote white-sounding name on a resume.
Frida, stay with us. We have to take a break. We'll finish that thought when we get back, okay?
Terrific.
Frida Kapoor-Klein is partner at the Kapoor Center for Social Impact. We're going to take a break. Our number, you can call it 844-724-8255. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about making tech a more diverse workplace with my guest, Frida Kapoor-Klein, partner at the Kapoor Center for Social Impact and founder of the Level Playing Field Institute based out of Oakland, California. Lots of interest in this from our listeners. Let's take a few calls. Let's go to Paul in San Jose. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, I'm a big fan. A great topic. I should preface, my mother back in the 60s and 70s was a working woman, and I have two daughters of my own. So, I am all for gender diversity, but having been within the ranks, I see that sometimes the intentions end up leading to a reverse discrimination, where you see a lot of capable men being passed over for promotions just because the goals have to be met towards having an equal number of women in the managerial positions. Take Cisco, for example. If you look at the number of executives that the new CEO appointed, you will find that he has 6 out of 12 women as his immediate executive staff. But the number of men and women within Cisco, the ratio is far towards men. So how do you, take into account that men and women are equally capable, how do you account for the fact that there are more women being represented in the executive positions than men? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Frida?
Well, I think the caller has raised a number of interesting and highly nuanced concerns. It's very important to understand what are the specific responsibilities and capabilities for each level of position. And again, as you point out, it makes perfect business sense to have diversity. So if diversity makes business sense, then we do want to make sure that it exists at every level of the organization. Schools have this problem. Schools think, let's just admit everybody who got perfect SAT scores, not paying attention to who has access to getting perfect SAT scores. Also, if all you do is hire clones of each other, people who are capable of doing the same thing, you don't get any of those advantages of diversity, especially in terms of innovation. So I think you have to write your requirements for executive leadership positions and every other level of position that include the people skills, mm-hmm. as well as what might be the hard coding skills or sales skills or other capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So it is both art and science in terms of constructing a large workforce.
Let me see if I can get one more call in before we have to go. Kyle in Boston. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I was one of the early employees with the Monster Board, and Freddie may remember this, back up in Maynard, Massachusetts about 20 years ago. What I see going on right now is that companies are forcing their HR and their recruiting teams to really chase after purple squirrels. What I mean by that is that you've got a finite number of female engineers graduating from the top engineering schools. You've got a finite number of African-American engineers coming out of these schools as well with good grades. And yet you're placing pressure on an Intel or a Google to get 10% or 20% of their hires when they aren't out there. They're just not out there. So I think it's kind of, again, chasing purple squirrels and forcing companies to hire people that just aren't out there.
But there are many studies that show that we graduate enough as scientists and engineers, plenty of scientists and engineers in universities, to fill all the jobs in America.
To fill all the engineering jobs?
Yeah, to fill the engineering. I can quote you. I don't want to go through them now, but I can quote you the studies. The Urban Institute talked about that there are plenty of graduates who could take those jobs.
So you're saying you can tell me how many African-American graduates come out of the top engineering school?
Well,
UCLA and Stanford?
I can't tell you but which percentage of them are, but let me ask Frieda about whether the point that Kyle's making is a valid one.
Well, we have both a pipeline problem and a leaky pipeline problem. And I heard there, if I think I heard you correctly, Kyle, I think you started to mention Stanford and another school. We have a huge set of biases towards what it means to graduate from a particular school. And those are proxies, not actual qualifications. So, for instance, I mentioned earlier the people ops technology companies that are proliferating. There are a couple of companies, Make School for one, Learners Guild is another, that are just starting out that are offering alternative computer science and engineering degrees competitive with absolutely top schools, but that don't require you to go into extraordinary debt. So I think what we need to do is to say, wait a second, which criteria do we use now and how biased are they? So we want to be plugging the pipeline problem and the leaky pipeline problem at the same time.
One last point to be made before we have to go. I know that you and your husband, Mitch Kapoor, the founder of Lotus, are pledging to invest in tech companies addressing diversity issues. What are you looking for in a company?
Well, so our pledge is with, if you're talking about our founder's commitment through K4 Capital, mm-hmm. we are asking our founders to set goals, but not cookie cutter goals. We're asking them to set goals that make sense for their business. So we're asking them to think about how closely over time can your employees demographically match your customers, for instance. We're asking them to invest in resources to achieve their goal, and we're supporting them in doing that. We're asking them to volunteer and get engaged in the communities in which they live and work and where their customers live and work. And we're asking them to educate their workforce about all of these fascinating issues of pipeline problems and leaky pipeline problems and hidden bias.
All right, we've run out of time, and I think your line is deteriorating. So we'll say goodbye. Thank you, Frieda. Frieda Kaper Klein is a partner at the Kaper Center for Social Impact and founder of the Level Playing Field Institute, based out of Oakland, California. 2 years ago, doctors at the University of Michigan were able to 3D print a trachea for a 16-month-old windpipe. That device saved the baby's life, and that trachea was made out of hard plastic. But what if we could print body parts that are more true to real life, made up of living cells? Doctors have been tinkering with 3D printers to regenerate tissue, and so far, the results have been mixed. Well, this week, researchers reported printing out ear, muscle, and bone tissue and implanting them in mice. The results were published in the journal Nature Biotechnology. My next guest is an author on that paper. Anthony Atala is the director of Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine. That's at, of course, Wake Forest University at Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Welcome to Science Friday.
Nice to be with you today.
Is the 3D printer that you use just like the one that people use to create jewelry and prototypes and stuff like that?
Well, you know, the concept's very similar, Ira. It's actually a very similar concept because, you know, you're at the end of the process, you're really printing structures. But the actual process, of course, can be very damaging to the cells. So you can print plastics and metals. The printing techniques are similar, but the strategy is to make sure that the cells don't get damaged during the printing process.
Tell us exactly how you print it.
Well, you know, it's actually a system we started to develop about 10 years ago, and it's basically based on the concept that you want to make sure that the cells go down through the nozzle, the printing nozzle, with actual survival. So the nozzles have to be very thin to be able to print precisely where you need the cells. But it's also important to make sure they survive. So we did that using various strategies. The main one was to make sure that we could lay down the cells and they would retain their structural integrity as you print them.
Tell us how you give it. Yeah, because you need to have them pretty sturdy. How do you give them that structural integrity?
That's a great question. Because, you know, the process is you want to make sure the cells go down to the nozzle as a liquid. But the moment it hits the surface, you want to make sure it's more like a gelatin. Because otherwise, it'll be just a blotch of fluid coming down. So you want it to basically hit the surface as a gelatin. And then you want it to harden as a gummy bear. And the whole process needs to happen at a time when the whole construct retains its structure. So we print a shell, if you will, around the structure. And this hard shell keeps everything in place. And once the construct is completed, once the printing is completed, we can then use water to dissolve the outer shell.
So you have a living tissue made out of the cells like an ear or it's muscle cells? How do you get the blood? You know, you have to get all that stuff to work from the body with it. How do you do that?
Another good point. You know, basically the challenge, of course, is to make sure that these things survive. You know, not just that you have the cells go through and be alive, but also to make sure that they remain alive and that they get fed. And the problem has been, of course, with nature, given us this a maximum distance of diffusion of nutrients of about 0.1 to 0.2 millimeters. That is, we can print small structures about 0.1 to 0.2 millimeters, and they're going to be fed just by the surrounding area. But anything larger, the cells in the center will not survive. So what we did is we basically built highways, microchannels, or highways into the central portion of the structure so the nutrients could get right in.
Mm-hmm. And so when you attach these, and you're attaching them to your lab animals, or do they just take up and grow the right cells in the right place?
Well, you know, the cells are already in place, but then when we implant them experimentally, right. what happens in the body is that the nutrients come in. You have that macrochannel or that highway system for the nutrients to come in and help the tissue survive. But then at the same time, the blood vessels from the body will start sprouting its capillaries or its, you know, tentacles, if you will, into the tissue, and it replaces the microchannels with the body's own blood vessels.
Hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Anthony Atala of Wake Forest. I understand that the ear cells that you tried came from a rabbit, and you implanted it into a mouse. And my question is, why wasn't it rejected, it being from a different kind of animal? Or another animal altogether?
Yeah, that's a good... basically, we use these mice that basically don't have a sophisticated immune system. So you can use other cell types that go in there. But when we, of course, we're doing this with plans to do this in patients. And if we were to treat a patient, the concept would be that we would take a small piece of tissue from the patient, and we would then grow the cells outside the body. Very small piece, less than half the size of a postage stamp. We would then grow the cells outside the body and then place those cells into the printing cartridges for the printing process.
Yeah, well, you
and
get...
And then we would...
Yeah, then you...
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. And I imagine you're going to say you then put it back in the patient.
Exactly. Then we put them back into the same patient and avoiding rejection.
Well, that is the $64 question now, right? When are you going to do that with people?
You know, certainly that's why we're doing this work, and we are currently, doing the safety trials, safety studies, preclinical studies that will hopefully lead us to our patient experience in the future.
Mm-hmm. And how soon do you think we could see that?
Well, you know, in science, as you know, it's always hard to predict when these things actually can get to patients because we do have the regulatory process to go through, but definitely that's something we're working on. Very hard to make sure that we can get that to patients in the future.
You know, something we always wondered about, remember back in the 90s, we all remember that human ear that was growing on the back of a rat? And
yes.
Well, there was a lot of promise. Now we're 20 years, almost 20 years later. How will 3D printed structures avoid the fate of the rat, I imagine, which is still not alive anymore?
That's exactly right. And, you know, the challenge, of course, was that you didn't have the right blood vessel supply going into it. And this has been a challenge now for quite some time. You know, how do you actually make sure that these tissues survive? And so, you know, it's easy to print small structures, But when you print large structures, you really do need that blood vessel supply, and that's what's really prevented some of these technologies from progressing.
Mm-hmm.
So by having these microchannels, you can really make that work. You know, these constructs do get vascularized and innervated once inside the body.
Also, what do you think the first body part will be tried out on a person?
Well, you know, there's a different level of complexity. All tissues are complex, but the least complex are flat structures such as skin. They're flat, mostly one major cell type. Tubular structures are the second level of complexity, like blood vessels. Two major cell types is tubular, not flat. Hollow non-tubular organs are the third level of complexity, like the stomach or the bladder. Architecture is more complex, more interaction with other organs. And finally, the most complex are the solid organs, like the liver, the heart, the lung. And, you know, we're going to follow that same path in terms of least complex to most complex as we take these things into the clinic.
Well, we wish you good luck with this. This is, you know, something we've been, as I say, starting with the ear on the rat, something we've all been following for years and waiting for some good positive results. So maybe we'll be hearing from you pretty soon on something, Anthony.
Well, hopefully so. It'll be a number of years, but hopefully we'll get there.
All right. We'll be here for you. Anthony Atala, director of Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine. That's, of course, at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners here at the studios of the City University of New York. We also had help today from Steve Regan at CSO Security News. And on the web this week, imagine coming across a stick insect nearly 2 feet long. Wow, that's what happened to a Melbourne museum employee a couple of years ago during a collections trip to the Australian tropics. And you can see them. They're kind of wild at sciencefriday.com/stickinsect. And also, just a reminder, if you're going to be in the New York area, we're going to have a cheese party, cheese tasting here in New York City. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com and get in on all of Murray's Cheese's great stuff here in New York. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.